The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
President Biden issues his first presidential veto over a bill that would ban ESG. President Xi of China and President Putin of Russia meet in Moscow. And Brandon Weikert, a foreign policy expert, joins us today. We're going to go on a world tour talking about Russia, Iran, China, and more. I'm Julie Hartman, and this is Timeless. Hey friends, it is Wednesday, March 22nd, 2023. Just a reminder to please like, comment, and subscribe to this show. You can also follow me at Julie R. Hartman on Instagram and Twitter. On to our first news story of the day. President Biden has issued his first presidential veto. This was over a bill that the Senate and the House passed to go to his office to sign that would lead the Department of Labor to consider climate change and other ESG factors in retirement plans investment decisions. It started out in the House of Representatives for this bill to ban ESG considerations in retirement plans, and it was approved by the House of Representatives, passed on February 28th by 216 to 204, and then it went over to the Senate, where it passed more narrowly by 50 to 46 with the help of West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and Montana Senator Joe Tester, both moderate Democrats who rightfully see that too much focus on ESG is harmful to investments. It's interesting because President Biden, he's about 2.5 years into office. This is his first presidential veto. And if you look at the history of other presidential vetoes, you can see that it has really decreased in the past few decades with our newer presidents. George W. Bush, Obama, and Trump issued a dozen or fewer vetoes over their time in office, whereas President Clinton and President George H.W. Bush issued three dozen vetoes. So the way that Congress was able to pass a law to try to overturn this regulation is because of the Congressional Review Act, which allows legislators to rapidly overturn a newly issued regulation. So the Department of Labor came up with this regulation to include ESG in investment decisions, which made Congress have the ability to overturn it. When President Biden vetoed this bill, he said, quote, "This bill would risk your retirement savings by making it illegal to consider risk factors that MAGA House Republicans don't like." Sort of a funny subversion of what was really going on. The bill, actually, by allowing ESG to be a consideration in retirement plans, what it would really do is it would make it legal for risk factors that left-wingers like to be considered into investment decisions. So it's a total, again, inversion of what is really going on. Coming from a president who has said recently that he would be willing to codify into law that minors have the right to undergo transgender surgeries, we can see that these ESG considerations are not merely, for lack of a better term, considerations. When the president and his fellow Democrats are saying that ESG and climate change should be taken into investment decisions, they are going overboard. They want a lot of their woke agendas to be considered in investments. But what they don't seem to understand, though they should in the wake of the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, which in large part failed because the Silicon Valley Bank was so invested in ESG and in wokeifying their investments, what President Biden doesn't understand is that investors have a fiduciary responsibility to act in the interests of their participants and beneficiaries. They need to invest money so that the people who are entrusting their money to them can have fulfilled retirement plans. They shouldn't be investing money to push forward woke causes. But President Biden's in lockstep, of course, with the left and the Democratic Party, shot this down. His veto is unlikely to be overridden. Constitutionally, it requires a two-thirds majority of Congress, both chambers of Congress, that is the Senate and the House of Representatives, to override a presidential veto. So it seems that this regulation that the Department of Labor will allow climate change and ESG factors in investment decisions for retirement plans will remain in effect. Now, on to other news, this time pertaining to foreign policy. President Xi Jinping of China has visited Moscow to meet with President Putin of Russia. This has been on the books for some time now. The two presidents have met dozens of times during their times in office, but this meeting was particularly important, especially given that China just negotiated a deal between the United States' two principal adversaries, Saudi Arabia and Iran, to thaw relations between them, and also because China is heavily aiding Russia during Russia's war effort against Ukraine. They have been buying Russian oil amid Western sanctions, and China has also boosted shipments of electronics, chips, and other goods. So President Xi in Moscow over the past few days has been greeted by a military band and parade. And President Xi and President Putin have referred to one another as, quote, dear friends. And they have talked about their, quote, friendship without limits. Xi told reporters that their countries have, quote, many similar goals. And, quote, with our cooperation and interaction, we will definitely achieve those goals. Again, that is sort of an ominous statement, given that both Russia and China have heavily rebuked the United States. They have spoken out against the unipolar world order in which the United States has really been the global hegemon. And it is an utmost priority for both of those countries to undermine the United States. So for them to say that their cooperation and interaction will achieve their shared goals, well, that should make us all a little nervous. They have even said as recently as this meeting that they want to provide a counterweight to U.S. hegemony. They have said that their alliance together will enter us into a new era of global stability without such United States control. They have argued that the West is trying to dominate Eastern Europe and the Asia-Pacific regions to, quote, contain the development of our two countries, Russia and China. After President Xi is done meeting with President Putin in Moscow, he will meet with Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. President Xi has said that he hopes to be a peacemaker, someone who can negotiate to end the war in Ukraine between Russia and Ukraine. Though, interestingly, he doesn't call it a war in Ukraine. He calls it the Ukraine crisis, which is, of course, his preferred name, so as not to tick off Russia, China's new ally, by calling it an invasion or a war. Recently, Washington, under the tutelage of the Biden administration, rejected a 12-point document that President Xi presented to the United States called China's Position on the Political Settlement of the Ukraine Crisis, which would try to create a path to negotiating a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that he is willing to embrace China's help, but he has made it clear that the only way that the war will end is if Russia agrees to hand back Russian-occupied territory of Ukraine. Now, President Xi has also recently devised a group called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is sort of a Eurasian counterpart to NATO, where he wants to gather a lot of allies in order to sort of be the arbiter of the new world order. So between what he has already accomplished, between thawing relations with Saudi Arabia and Iran and helping Russia and seeming to want to push this war in Ukraine to an end, it appears that President Xi is succeeding at replacing the United States as this arbiter of the global world order. Speaking of foreign policy, I am honored to welcome Brandon Weikart to Timeless today. He is a foreign policy expert who manages the Weikart Report, World News Done Right. He is also a contributing commentator to publications such as The American Spectator and American Greatness, and he is also a senior editor at 1945.com. I read on his website that Brandon lives by Herman Kahn's mantra, quote, "I am against fashionable thinking." Therefore, his entire life work has been predicated on challenging conventional wisdom and assumptions on a variety of matters, most notably in foreign policy. He is the author of three books, Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower, The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy, and the forthcoming book, which I have pre-ordered, it comes out on May 16th, Biohacked, China's Race to Control Life. Brandon, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here. I've been watching your show for a little bit now, so I really enjoy it.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know that I love talking about foreign policy. I was telling Brandon before the show that I feel like Timeless has enabled me to speak more competently at dinner parties because I can throw out names of presidents of other countries that I now know thanks to this profession. You probably know all of them. So we're sort of going to go on a journey around the world today for this interview because you are obviously a foreign policy expert and there is so much going on in the world right now. So I'm going to take us through a few regions. But of course, let's start with China, which has been in the news recently. I don't even know how many times I've reported on it in the past 2 weeks. China has made some pretty serious rebukes against the United States, saying that we are supposedly engaging in all-round encirclement and containment. They recently facilitated a deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran to thaw relations. And as recently as 2 days ago, President Xi met with President Putin in Russia. So President Xi just regained his third presidential term. What do you see President Xi doing in this term? Do you think that he is going to step up his boldness and policy that characterized his last term? Are the reports true that China's suffering economically, it's suffering population-wise, and that we shouldn't be as scared of China as we are? What's your assessment of this adversary of ours?
I think anybody who's saying China's going to go away anytime soon needs to have their head examined. Maybe if we're lucky, the regime collapses. But that's not a fait accompli. And frankly, what would follow the regime in China might not be any better. And so I would just sort of put those claims that China's going to collapse anytime soon, I'd put those in a box and package them and not think about it for a little bit. What I recommend to policymakers pretty regularly, in fact, I'm going up to D.C. on Thursday of this week to meet with the Air Force on this topic of Chinese technology and their growth, economic growth. We need to anticipate that China will be with us for a while. President Xi just got his third term. He was able to basically, even in the wake of these very damaging zero COVID lockdown policies of his, he was able to both maintain his power and to wipe out his rivals. We saw that with Jiang Zemin. We saw that with Hu Jintao. These cliques and factions of rivals who really stood a chance because of the zero COVID lockdowns of undermining and usurping Xi, they were all wiped out pretty easily, actually. So Xi Jinping is going to be with us for a while. And China, while they did certainly suffer economic downturns because of COVID and the related COVID lockdowns and the supply chain issues, China's weathering the storm fairly well. And we're seeing now this budding relationship where for a while now, Chinese leaders have wanted to marry Chinese power with Russian power. And now it's happening because of the somewhat feckless U.S. foreign policy or obsession with Ukraine. We now see that Russia is happily opening up the back door and letting the Chinese into Russia, so much so that I believe Russia is basically becoming a vassal state of the new Chinese empire as led by Emperor Xi. And so China's not going away, and they're finding ways to survive when we assume they would decline. And about the population issue, it's certainly true that China has a population, a demography crisis. But that's also reflected throughout most of the developed world. And in fact, if you look at the data coming out from these fertility rates of the Middle East and much of the developing world, they're going to be having a fertility and a demographic crisis as well over the next 15 to 20, maybe 30 years. So it's more of a symptom of modern society wholesale rather than just a Chinese phenomenon. China has certain specific problems that they have because of policies in the past, like the One China policy that's unique to China. But now we're seeing China, the abundance of Chinese young men are actually marrying the abundance of Russian young women in the Russian Far East. And so now you have a whole new fusion of Chinese and Russian power, which is along these sort of interpersonal familial connections, which could be very complicating for the United States as it tries to prevent a Eurasian superpower from being birthed, which is what's happening now. So China's not going away.
That is so interesting. I did not know that what you just said about that Chinese men are marrying Russian women. Boy, I call them eerily brilliant. They are so sneaky and shrewd with their ways of infiltrating into other countries. You know, it's not shocking to hear that you say that Russia may be a client state of China, because even if you look at the past 40 to 50 years, China has seen a stunning ascent, whereas Russia actually has seen a stunning descent. We think it's the opposite because of Putin's invasion of Ukraine, but actually the population, at least, of Russia is way less technologically skilled, way less healthy than the Chinese population. And in 1991, the Russia went from being this imperial-like power of the Soviet Union and its Eastern European satellite states, and now its power is diminished hugely. So,
oh yes,
yes, go ahead.
Yes, well, basically, we saw this yesterday when President Xi met with President Putin, and Putin gave a speech after the meeting in which he said that, well, first of all, he told Xi to his face that Russia is very jealous of the development and the economic growth that China has experienced. And then Putin gave a speech afterward in which he said that he wants the Russians to start trading their oil and fossil fuel resources in the Chinese yuan. And he wants to start getting the developing world to start doing that as well, so that they can counteract the dominance that the dollar has. And so you're seeing the birth of a new economic union across Eurasia, led by China. Big things have small beginnings, so it's going to start small, and Xi Jinping is going to be very sort of tepid about it because he doesn't want to bring American ire totally down on him too early in this enterprise. But you can rest assured, or maybe it's not assured, you could be very concerned, as I am, that this is part of a much longer-running multi-year plan at collapsing the dollar and displacing the dollar dominance and replacing the U.S. economy with a more bifurcated system that's one side led by a rising Beijing and another side led by a declining Washington, D.C. And sadly, right now, the United States is definitely a superpower in decline, and the Chinese are on the ascendancy. And so now you're seeing that play out in the economic domain, which is actually more disconcerting and more serious of a threat, I would argue, than even the military threat of China. They remain still a geoeconomic threat, transitioning to a more traditional geopolitical threat. But if we don't start meeting and matching China in the geoeconomic realm, we won't have a military capable of resisting China, because they will have invested all that extra money into creating a much more modern dynamic force than ours.
The realm of predictions is tricky business, but if you had to suspect, do you think in 20 years from now, we, the United States, may be at risk of being a Chinese client state? As I said a few minutes ago, the Chinese are so eerily shrewd with the ways that they infiltrate us. Certainly what you were talking about just now is an example. They've also stationed police stations across the United States, including in New York City. We know a lot, especially from the news lately, that they spy on 120 million Americans through TikTok. They are the ones creating and manufacturing the fentanyl, which the Mexican drug cartels funnel across our borders. And as just icing on the cake, I could list many more examples. They have killer satellites in space, which can be used to knock out even our satellites. So it doesn't seem like the push of history here is really in our favor. Is it too dramatic to imply that we may one day, in the near future, be a client state of China?
Well, in many respects, we already are. I mean, they were our number one trading partner for years. The current president, Biden, when he was a senator, the head of the very powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I previously worked on Capitol Hill, so the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate side was extremely prestigious, and that Biden ran it for so long gave him a lot of clout, and he was personally responsible for shepherding through the Senate the push to get China to become a member of the World Trade Organization and to give them the most favored nation trade status that they received in December of 2001. From that moment onward, China's ascent was assured, and that was entirely a voluntary move by the United States. At the time, we didn't think China was an enemy. We thought they would always be these sort of this little power that we could sort of treat like a child almost, and have them be our slave shop or sweatshop rather. But going back to Deng Xiaoping, actually even Mao Zedong talked about eventually as his slogan in 1949 was catch up to Great Britain and overtake the United States. This has been part of a long-running plan. We hear this epitomized by Xi Jinping's 2049 policy, which is to basically have China as the number one world superpower by the 100th year anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. And they've managed to do this pretty much less through military operations and more so through trade and economic deals. And in many respects, like I said, they've certainly co-opted a large chunk, many generations now, of a large chunk of our elite. And we see this most explicitly with the Hunter Biden scandal, but it goes so much farther beyond Hunter Biden. His is almost a cartoonish level of corruption. I worked and lived in D.C. for many years, and I saw it firsthand the way that the Chinese would hire lobbyists and the Chinese would use cutouts to sort of entrap American business leaders, politicians, all of it a relatively legal means, of course, with very illicit objectives. But we're already deeply enmeshed in China's new empire. Just look at what happened during COVID. We were worried that if we went too hard after China for what I obviously believe was a lab leak, that they would, in response and retaliation, cut us off from our access to critical antibiotics and other medications that are almost exclusively produced in China. And that reality has not changed since 2020. In fact, in some ways, Wall Street and some of these financial firms are becoming incredibly more dependent on China. And many of the tech firms are still doing business with China. And so in many respects, key elements of our elite society are already part of the Chinese empire, which is why I think we haven't stood up to China the same way we stood up to Russia, which, let's face it, Vladimir Putin simply hasn't spent enough money to buy out our elites as the Chinese have.
Mm-hmm. A Chinese university professor with ties to the CCP. It sounds even dumb for me to say, because every Chinese university professor has ties to the CCP. Di Dongsheng remarked when President Biden was elected in November of 2020 that it would be easier to manipulate him than it was for President Trump. And he bragged about how the Chinese, as you were saying, have infiltrated into the United States government and into our institutions. Two questions for you before we move on to other parts of the world on our grand world tour today. If President Biden wins the re-election in 2024, do you think that China may take even greater steps to try to contain us? Because according to Di Dongsheng and according to just about anyone in the CCP, they view President Biden as weak because they have bought him off and he is weak. Do you think if he wins in 2024, China's going to really step up its even military game against us? And then on the flip side, let's say President Biden doesn't win in 2024. What could a next presidential candidate do to combat this infiltration by China that has already taken place?
Well, these are great questions. Let me start with the second one first, because I think that if you have an honest leader from either party, this is something that any president could do. In fact, I met with Rand Paul in 2019, and he was very interested in doing this, and then COVID hit and it never came to fruition. But something very simply is one of the biggest problems we have with China keeping up with us at the technological level is that they are just soaking up all of our new innovations faster than we can protect them. And one of the reasons we can't protect those innovations is because our tech companies want to do business over there. It's a huge market share, and if they can gain access to it, especially if they can get exclusive access to it over their competitors, that's a huge boost for their profit margins. And so we see a lot of American tech companies agree to China's demand of basically tech transfers, giving critical, sensitive, proprietary technologies over to the Chinese and partnering with Chinese state-owned entities so that basically the American firms can build up their own competition in China that will eventually displace them. What I said to Rand Paul and what I talk about in Biohack, my next book, is we should classify all or most of those tech transfers that these tech companies do as bribes under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. They're not currently classified as that, but you know, how corporate America works is if there's a low risk, high reward, they're going to go for that path of least resistance. So just by Congress stepping in and reclassifying most, if not all, of tech transfers to China as exactly that, a bribe, basically you've just raised the risk far too high for these many, most of these tech companies to risk doing business on the level that they have thus far with China. Another thing to use that any president could use is the Committee for Investment into the United States, CFIUS. Now, when I was on the Hill, I did a lot of coordination with this DOJ group, and it's an entity that basically, as the name suggests, looks over foreign acquisitions of sensitive land, companies, whatever, in America or American-based firms from foreign entities and make sure that nothing untoward is going on. And so we have a history of checking, CFIUS does, of checking these Chinese acquisitions of critical land, of technology firms like Fairfield Semiconductors in 2012. What I propose doing is giving that committee more power and more strength to basically go after and scale up that attempt to slow down Chinese acquisitions, because basically they're undermanned and they are not able to stop everything because China's doing this full frontal press where they're basically just taking as much as they can. Sometimes they get slapped on the wrist. Sometimes they don't. Most of the time they don't. So those are two things that I would recommend any president do right now. It's non-kinetic. It's completely within the geoeconomic sphere, and it would completely stymie and complicate China's efforts to keep up with the Americans. Now, if Biden, God help us, is reelected, which he stands a very good chance. People need to understand he stands a very good chance of winning reelection. If he is reelected, there are two things that are probably going to happen. On the one hand, China's going to get real aggressive with Taiwan. They might even try to hit Taiwan. But in the long run, you're definitely going to see an attempt by Biden to do the mother of all geopolitical, geoeconomic, and climate change deals with China, wherein basically we're going to try to return to that Neil Ferguson formulation of Chimerica, the opposite of what Trump was doing, which was basically to divorce us from China. You're going to see in a second term where Biden is not inhibited by needing to run for re-election again, a long-running attempt to basically cede the high ground in geopolitical and geoeconomic competition to China. And I think that's going to, we're already seeing the formation of that. You're already seeing that happen. And I think that's going to go into high gear over the next couple years if he is reelected, so much so that by the last year and a half, probably China will have the high ground, and we will be living in, for all intents and purposes, a Chinese-dominated world order.
God help us was right. I thought that yesterday, too, when I was leafing through the New York Times, and all of a sudden I saw not one, not two, not three, but four full-page ad for TikTok in the New York Times, which said, we're not stealing your data. We have a U.S. team that is helping ensure privacy. Again, God help us all, is certainly right.
Let me just
right.
interrupt you right there, because sure. It's so funny, because I do these talks with the Air Force, and very often the Pentagon will bring in different members of the Innovation Hub, just from different, you know, the Air Force Innovation Lab, or from DARPA, or from DIU. Phenomenal group, by the way, at DIU. But they'll bring in some of these also defense contractors. And one of the guys, about a year ago, at one of my talks in D.C., one of the guys from this team that was ensuring that our data was protected, I cornered him after I gave my talk, because he got very testy with me when I was attacking TikTok, and basically got him to admit that actually, because everything is run through China, ultimately, there's only so much that this American team can do to protect the users in America are data. And then when I brought up the fact that, well, how do you, you know, not, how do you deal with the fact that the program that the Americans are using is different than the program that the Chinese kids are using? And he said, well, there's nothing we can do about that. That's ultimately a content issue that relates to the home company in China. And so even when you're talking about how American teams are protecting our data, that's a bunch of malarkey, as Biden would say. They can't guarantee our data is protected. This is all about the money. They want, everybody wants a slice of that financial pie, and you can't blame them. But ultimately, our security and the security and well-being of our kids is not being well maintained or protected, and they never will be as long as they're using this app. We should do what India did and outright ban it.
Thank you for sharing that, because now we have an entity like the New York Times trying to gaslight us into thinking that the Chinese are not, in fact, pulling the strings behind all of this. Exactly. So let's move on to Iran. This week actually marks 20 years since the United States invasion of Iraq. And what's stunning to see now in a total twist of history is that although Saddam Hussein of Iraq invaded Iran in 1980, now, Iraq is a client state of Iran today. We also know that Iran has been very generous with helping Russia in the war effort against Ukraine, most recently setting up a drone factory in Russia. And then, as you so eerily and eloquently told us, Russia is sort of becoming a client state of China. So my question for you is the state of this multipolar world. You know, as background for much of our history, or at least modern history, we were a bipolar world between the United States, the Soviet Union. Then we were a multipolar world with the United States just really sort of having global hegemony for certainly the first decade of the 21st century. Now we're in this multipolar world where we're a superpower. We have Iran, though. We have China. We have Russia. Sort of now we're seeing Saudi Arabia. But if Iran is aiding Russia, and Russia is a client state of China, is Iran really a multipolar competitor of China? Or do you think that China is going to shift its sights towards Iran and making Iran a client state, which means, sorry to get too complicated for the audience, but then that means Iraq is also would be a client state of China, because Iraq is now a client state of Iran.
Right. Well, and the reason that the Iraq is a semi-client state of Iran is because it has a majority Shiite population,
right.
And the Iranians are the Shiite, you know, country of the region, and so that's called part of the Shiite Crescent. Anybody who studied the Middle East or the Greater Middle East in recent years will recognize that term. It's been used quite a bit, but basically that's why Iraq. Because when we remove Saddam, who was Sunni, which is what the Saudis are and what much of the Middle East is, when we remove Saddam, he was a minority group. The Sunnis are a minority group in Iraq along with the Kurds. It's the Shiites who have all the majority, and they were suppressed by Saddam. And then when we remove Saddam, the elections naturally elected majority Shiite governments, which means they're now in hock to the Shiite government of Iran. So that's why Iraq is now sort of a proto or quasi colony of Iran. The question about China and Iran, China has already basically colonized Iran beginning about a year and a half, 2 years ago. They signed this incredible $400 billion multi-year oil development, natural gas development deal with Iran that's exclusive. And so basically China, and in fact, members of the Iranian parliament were protesting publicly this decision by the mullahs and the IRGC to allow this deal to go forward, saying that you're going to replace the British colonizer with the Chinese colonizer, and it's going to have the same effect on Iran. It's going to make us a vassal of China. And that's exactly what's already happening. And the mullahs don't care, because they just want protection from the West and from Israel. I don't know how far that protection from China would go. Let's say if Israel were to strike Iran soon, would China then allow for Iran to launch back at Israel? I don't know, especially because China wants to incorporate Israel into their high-tech Belt and Road initiative. So I don't know how far that would go. But Iran is already a vassal state of China because of the oil dependency that China has and the natural gas dependency. And then furthermore, Russia, since 2015 at least, has used Iran as a staging ground for their sorties into Syria to combat the head choppers and the Syrian rebel rebellion. And so protecting Bashar al-Assad is what they're doing. And so Iran is already in many respects a colony of both Russia and China, which is a significant threat to the United States. And it's only going to get worse the more that the Americans haphazardly pull out of the region. Donald Trump created the Abraham Accords, and he paired that with his maximum pressure campaign on Iran, which was the Abraham Accords was basically marrying Sunni Arab, led by the Saudis, power to Israel, which would have ended decades of tension and conflict between the Israelis and the Sunnis. Most of the wars Israel has fought have not been against the Shiites in Iran. They've been against the Sunni community. And so that would have married those two powers and probably led to a natural end of a lot of the tension with the Palestinians, and would have allowed for sort of a new, almost NATO-like regional security bloc to contain Iran, which both the Sunnis and the Israelis don't want to see break out. But now, because Biden took over and he abandoned that deal and basically began attacking over the airwaves, going after Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, and going after the Israelis for supposed human rights violations, basically we have created a situation where especially the Saudis are looking to other groups now to protect them. And they've now turned into their desperation to China. China's already a bigger client of theirs for energy. So it's a natural fit now for Saudi Arabia to swing the Sunni community away from Israel and into the Chinese camp, and by extension, the Iranian camp and the Russian camp, which means that the Israelis and the United States are now the odd man out. And don't be surprised if Israel decides to take China up on its offer to become part of the new Middle East Belt and Road Initiative, the high-tech Belt and Road Initiative. And suddenly now America's totally boxed out of a region that we've committed a lot of resources and lives to maintaining our power in since 1945. So that's what's going on in the Middle East. It's a nightmare, and it's entirely American-made. We destabilized the region, and we didn't have a plan for putting Humpty Dumpty back together again. And Trump, who was considered a lunatic by his opponents, actually had a viable plan, a strategy for doing the rebuilding. And then, of course, he lost his re-election, and now we have the same kind of people who got us into this mess under Biden now leading us again, and it's going nowhere fast. It's going in the wrong direction.
It is scary to even see Israel sort of succumb to Chinese encroachment. I was reading recently that China has purchased a terminal at one of or several of ports in Israel. Just to clarify before I move on to my next question, so I understand your argument about the Abraham Accords that Trump initiated, which created diplomatic relations between Israel and the neighboring Sunni Arab states. What you're arguing is that President Biden's rebuke of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, sort of created some icy tensions, not only with the United States, but also with Israel, that sort of frayed the progress that was achieved through the Abraham Accords. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. It's completely impeded the progress. And now we have a new player on the board who does not want to see the Abraham Accords go forward, because the Abraham Accords favor American power being maintained through proxies like Israel and the Sunni states. China is now in the driver's seat of the region, and they don't want to see American power maintained, because they're worried if a crisis breaks out between them and us, that we could still use our power and influence in the region to cut off China from their essential not natural gas and critical oil supply. So basically, by co-opting both Iran and Saudi Arabia, and therefore the Sunni Arab states, the Chinese are making a play to not only stunt American power projection in the region, but to move most of the region, to drag it away from the United States and the West and into this new Chinese empire. And it's working so far. And in another 10 years, I suspect that they will probably have won that fight.
I understand China's role here in their incentive to bring Saudi Arabia and Iran together, as they successfully did just about 2 weeks ago. But I'm still a little bit hung up on these icy relations between Saudi Arabia and the United States. As you said, President Biden did rebuke the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. I remember that he specifically rebuked him after the CIA found that Mohammed bin Salman was behind the assassination of the Saudi-born Washington Post writer Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey. Is this really over a rebuke, though, between President Biden and Saudi Arabia? I mean, maybe I don't understand how fragile the relations are here, but it seems to be a bit dramatic on the part of Saudi Arabia, as much as I dislike President Biden, to view his rebuke of them as a way to sort of turn away from the progress made in the Abraham Accords and towards Iran and China.
Well, this cuts back to the fact that the United States for the last decade has been diminishing its reliance on foreign sources of oil and was until recently standing up its own domestic energy production capabilities. This also gets back to the left's obsession with committing America 100% over the next decade to alternative energy sources, which is a huge threat to the Saudi plan. They need global prices of energy to remain relatively high as the Crown Prince takes Saudi Aramco public, and they uses that public, that IPO, that initial public offering, to fund what he wants to be, which is Saudi Arabia is no longer the oil capital of the Middle East or of the world, but becomes a dynamic tech innovation hub, which is another reason, by the way, why China wants access to Saudi Arabia, because they recognize the potential for technology development there, and they're trying to grow their innovation hubs in China by partnering with foreign sources. So that's part of the reason. Another reason is the fact that the Biden administration, unlike Trump, is committed to the Iranian nuclear deal, which is a direct threat to Saudi Arabia. If Iran gets nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia does not yet have those systems. We won't give it to them. And one day, Saudi Arabia, Riyadh, is afraid of waking up and finding that Tehran has a large and growing arsenal of nuclear weapons that have been allowed to them by the Iran nuclear agreement that Obama created in 2015, that Trump discontinued, and now Biden is desperately trying to get back into, against the counsel of some of his national security advisors like Brett McGurk, who's much more of a hawk on this issue. But that's part of the reason. Another part of the reason is it goes back to the 2016 election. Had Hillary Clinton won, Mohammed bin Salman's cousin, Mohammed bin Nayef, would have likely become the crown prince heir apparent. Mohammed bin Nayef was the head or one of the guys, the architects of Saudi Arabia's counter-terrorist strategy after 2003, which meant he had a lot of connections to America's so-called deep state, to the CIA in particular. He had a lot of benefactors in the permanent bureaucracy. And when Trump became president unexpectedly, his people favored Mohammed bin Salman because of Mohammed bin Salman's harsher stances on Iran. And they felt in the Trump administration he wasn't as tainted by Hillary Clinton and these connections that MBN, Mohammed bin Nayef, had to the CIA. And so what happened was there was sort of this internal feud between sort of the more traditional elements of the intelligence community here in the West and some of the Trump people. And they viewed MBS as a dangerous, unpredictable person who wouldn't necessarily follow the guidance of the West as relates to or as it's dictated to by the permanent bureaucracy. So there was that undercurrent as well. Biden, of course, represents the more established element of the so-called, I call it the administrative state. Trump called it the deep state, whatever. But that's what we're talking about here, is this relationship between the administrative state, the permanent bureaucracy, who favored MBN over MBS. And one other thing about Jamal Khashoggi, it was terrible what happened to him. I would have never recommended doing that had I been advising MBS. But it is a fact that Jamal Khashoggi was an Islamist, and that until the mid-90s, he was very close with Osama bin Laden. And he did not support bin Laden's militant approach to Islamism, to jihad, but he most certainly was in favor of spreading jihad and Islam, creating a bunch of emirates like bin Laden helped create in Afghanistan across the greater Middle East. And so he was certainly a fellow traveler. Jamal Khashoggi was in the camp of Mohammed bin Nayef. Jamal Khashoggi was he was not a journalist. He was an agent. He was a go-between between the Saudi intelligence services and the CIA. And that was why the Washington Post, of course, gave him a sinecure after he was excommunicated or exiled by MBS in Saudi Arabia. But the fact of the matter is there was an internal dispute between the royal family, between elements of MBS and MBN over who would succeed the king. And Jamal Khashoggi was on the wrong side of that. And that is why that is the main reason why he was killed.
Mm. Moving on to a discussion of you're laughing. You're like, we talking about the Saudis going back to Russia and that land. Yeah, we're going
all
on a
roads
tour
could
here.
Lead back to Beijing.
I was just about to say all roads unfortunately do lead back to China. So let's talk about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You recently published an article that I read called "Ukraine is going to lose." Where was that published, by the way?
A contributor at the Asia Times. And they tend to publish my more provocative pieces.
It was provocative, but look, if you look at the facts now, as much as we hope that is not true, it seems as though it is. Right now, the war in Ukraine is a war of attrition, and as we know from the American Civil War and the Eastern Front in World War II, the side with the bigger economy and the bigger population tends to win, which Russia has. Also, we, the United States, I don't know, if you look back, we sort of have a track record of going into places and then getting tired and leaving. And yeah. We already see that support for, note sarcasm, by the way, we already see that support for Ukraine has diminished. And then, of course, Russia has forces like Iran and China behind them to help them. So because all roads lead back to China, let's assess the situation here. If you are right that Russia prevails in Ukraine, even if it just takes the eastern Donbass region, or if it takes all of Ukraine, what is the long-term future for Ukraine and for the also former Soviet socialist republics around Russia? Because if Russia, as you are saying, is a client state of China, then if Russia is taking control of Ukraine and possibly Moldova and other SSRs, are those going to become client states of China?
Well, that remains to be seen. So a year ago, I was on with Steve Bannon's show, and I said that, you know, it looks like Russia really wants to create a civilization state. So, yes, if I were Moldova and some of these former these former Soviet client states, I'd be very worried. But now, after a year of attrition, I think that while the Russians are winning and going to win, I think that if they get to the point that they've collapsed the Ukrainian state and that there is no more independent Ukraine, I think that probably they will, at the very least, temporarily stop, maybe for another 7 to 10 year interlude, as there was between their invasion of Crimea and their initiation of hostilities with Ukraine in last year. And the reason I say that is because they certainly have taken heavy losses, and they are being drained in the field, and they're going to need time to re-equip and rearm. And so I think that if the Russians no longer believe that Ukraine is a viable, independent country that can be used as a what they thought would be a launching pad by NATO on conventional warfare into Russia, they might be okay with drawing a dividing line between West and Eastern Ukraine, much as there was in West and Eastern Germany in the Cold War, and just calling that a day. What I have argued recently, and nobody likes this, but this was actually something Putin suggested to the Poles in 2010, and it's not palatable, and I say this as, you know, with a heavy heart, but I think that what Poland should do now is move a large force into Western Ukraine and to basically Polonize Galicia, which is Western Ukraine, and draw a line of control there and say, look, Russia, you're going to take everything, the Russian-speaking parts that you've held to the east, you'll keep Crimea, but you're not going to cross this line. And I don't think the Russians will go guns blazing across that line, at least right away. That gives us time to figure out what we're going to do in the long term. If I were Moldova, though, I would be very concerned because they're so close and so small to Russian power. Russia has about 1,500, definitely not the best and brightest of their troops, stationed in Moldova. I don't really know if there's much they can do yet. I think that Putin has definitely had to recalibrate his larger aims, Whereas a year ago, had he not met resistance, I think he probably would have charged into trying to build a land bridge between his zone and Serbia and maybe going after Finland and maybe going after some of these other countries. I think he's had to recalibrate things down. If he can walk away from this conflict in the next year, and I think it'll be in the next year, if he can walk away from this conflict with most, if not all, of Ukraine and certainly Belarus, I think he'll be fine. I think he'll be satisfied, and then we're going to have to deal with a whole new situation, which is that when Ukraine falls, if it's a complete defeat, which is what's going to happen if Poland doesn't step in and Polonize Western Ukraine, if it's a complete defeat, then we're going to have a problem of NATO no longer having credibility and certainly not having the kind of arms and supplies it needs to stop a Russian thrust deeper into Europe, rather, from Ukraine, which means if that's the worst case scenario, then we're talking nuclear war, then we're talking about end of the whole ball game. So I think that what we're going to be dealing with, if we don't take control of mitigating that threat of Ukraine collapsing and NATO therefore being left vulnerable, I think it's a nightmare scenario. So Poland needs to move in. Maybe Hungary also sends some troops. Needs to be a NATO effort. When this is over, there's not going to be a Ukraine state. Putin will get what he wants. There will be no more Ukraine when this is all said and done.
I wonder if the Ukrainians would view the Polonization, as you put it, of Western Ukraine as similar to what Russia was doing by invading them, because Poland was in the 20th century, or excuse me, Western Ukraine in the 20th century was a part of Poland.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they certainly would. It is, when I bring this up, I get death threats from Ukrainian Twitter bots. Mm. I really don't care. This is better than nuclear war. And if I were living in Western Ukraine, I would welcome Poland, which is probably the most dynamic country in Europe. I would welcome them taking over the land rather than seeing a Russian thrust come through there. We know what the Russians do when they go through Ukraine. Western Ukraine has been left relatively untouched. That will change soon if the Ukrainians do a breakout into that second defensive line, and I think they will soon under these conditions. And that's flat land for their armor. They're not going to be having the kind of slog soon that they've been having like they did around Bakhmut, which, by the way, they still won. Nobody wants to talk about this. Everybody wants to engage in happy thinking. I don't do that. This is time for real hard-nosed strategy. It's a lose-lose right now for NATO. Do they want to lose little or lose big? Losing big is doing nothing, is keeping doing what we've been doing and expecting different results, which, as you know, is the definition of insanity, and it's also a surefire way to lose. If we do what I'm saying, it's a smaller defeat, and we can live to fight another day, regroup, rearm, probably create a new stable balance of power in the region that would allow us to refocus and rededicate our limited efforts to the Indo-Pacific and the Middle East, which are both far more important to American strategic interests than little Europe is.
Before I ask this next question, I'd like to encourage the audience to get out a wine glass and a big bottle of wine. A, because you may need it after this conversation. Boy, the world is in a bad state. But B, because I want to ask you about the nuclear threat that you just brought up. I was listening to John Mearsheimer recently, who was talking about this shift from the bipolar world that we were in during the time of the Soviet Union to a U.S.-led unipolar world to a multipolar world. And one of the things that he posited is that actually a nuclear threat is more likely in a multipolar world now, where there are many different superpowers sort of vying for the top spot, as I mentioned, the United States, Iran, Russia, China, to an extent, Saudi Arabia. He said it's actually more likely that we get into a nuclear war now than it was during the time of the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union had more to lose if it engaged in a nuclear war. As mentioned, not just the Russian motherland, but the 14 constituent Soviet socialist republics, not to mention the satellite states that they basically controlled in Eastern Europe. Now Russia has lost all of that. They are trying to get Ukraine. They have been met with fierce resistance, as we know. So they may be more willing to act impulsively if they think that it will get some kind of gain for them, because they figure, well, we've lost a lot. You know, what more do we have to lose? We might as well just do it. Do you think there is merit to that argument? And how likely do you think in the next couple of years we may be in nuclear war, and with whom?
So I think Mearsheimer is almost completely correct in everything he's asserted. I would define it down even, I know I said earlier multipolar, I would define it down actually to tripolar. It's really a contest between the big dogs, America, China, and Russia, and then some of these medium-sized powers that right beneath that, and we're sort of vying for influence over them. In my opinion, a tripolar system is even more unstable than a multipolar system, which is four or more powers. And Richard Rosskrantz, his works in the 1970s have really proved this when he, and then also Randall Schweller, he really looked at this when he looked at the interwar period, in which he posited there were, in fact, three powers in that period between, it was the United States, he was talking about industrial powers, the United States, the Soviet Union, and the German, or rather the Nazis. And he said that Britain at that point was too far gone in its decline to really be counted. And really, it was three powers. And what happened was the three powers, it's like three legs of an unstable stool. They're always trying to balance against each other. When you have four or more players, you can do that pretty evenly, and you create some kind of stability. But when you have three players, it's very unstable, especially when those three players are not purely evenly matched, which we are not. And so I think that when you look at that system, it's going to lead to a world war. I would argue we're probably already in a world war. It's at least the opening contours of one. We do not have the right leaders in any capital that will be able to pull us back from that, which is why I say we're probably going into one. And so this tripolar system is inherently unstable. It will collapse. It will flatten on itself. You're going to see a greater chance of, yes, nuclear warfare. I think the great sin here, and this was what my first book, Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower, was a large chunk of it was about, was saying how ridiculous it was that we didn't follow through on Reagan's calls for a space-based missile defense network. Mm. We could have had that running fully by now and probably had the homeland mostly defended from nuclear brinksmanship. But of course, the permanent bureaucracy didn't want to upset the apple cart in the relationship that we had with Moscow too much. And so we didn't do that. And because we've left ourselves vulnerable to this kind of attack, naturally, our enemies, whether it's Russia, China, Iran, or North Korea, are happily looking to exploit those advantages. And so if you look at the balance of nuclear forces, Russia has way more tactical nuclear, non-strategic nuclear weapons than we do. They have them forward deployed in the Kaliningrad and other parts. We've now deployed some of our gravity bombs into NATO countries for the first time in probably 30 years. We're headed toward that point. And I would also add a more controversial point, which nobody wants to address, given the kind of ideologues that we have running the show, both here in Washington and in Brussels. There is a chance that it isn't the Russians who do go nuclear. I know Mearsheimer doesn't think this, but I'll just be controversial here. There's a chance that if all seems lost, the NATO countries do a Parthian shot with a nuke at the Russians. And that initiates something even worse than what we've been going through, thinking that maybe we could, if we do a first strike, maybe we can prevent all from being lost. That's a controversial take. I know a lot of people don't believe that, and I'm willing to be proven wrong on that. But the way that we have so committed ourselves, overcommitted ourselves to the Ukrainian cause at the expense of pretty much all other elements of American national strategy, I wouldn't be surprised if we did something crazy like that. Without that being done, the only way I see right now Putin resorting to nukes is if it looks like the Ukrainians are going to take Crimea. And if they take Crimea or they're about to take Crimea, then yes, nuclear, tactical nuclear weapons for sure will be deployed to soften up those Ukrainian lines. Failing that, though, right now Putin has no reason to use nukes. He's doing fine with conventional forces. I know we in the West don't think so because we're used to these clean surgical wars, but the Russians historically are not used to that. They fight really nasty wars of attrition. And so they really don't need that just yet. They might, but they don't need it just yet. I'd be more concerned about a Russian breakout soon past those Ukrainian defensive perimeters in the east that gives them open access highway to Kyiv, which I think is now the objective.
Mm. I think you're right about Crimea maybe being the thing that might provoke Russia. There was recently this CIA agent, David Petraeus, who said that there was still an open dispute as to whether or not Russia could still have control over Crimea. And Alexander Formanchuk, one of the representatives for the Kremlin, said that it will undoubtedly escalate into thermonuclear conflict if they try to retake Crimea. There's so much more I wish that I could ask you, but unfortunately we are out of time. But oh well, I guess I'll just have to have you on again soon.
I would love to. Let me know. I'm always available.
Well, thank you very much for your time. And as a reminder, Brandon's forthcoming book is called Biohacked, China's Race to Control Life. Please pre-order it. As I said at the beginning, I have. And I look forward to speaking with you soon, Brandon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us today. And remember that each of our thoughts, choices, and actions shape who we are. So let's think clearly, choose wisely, and act with principle and determination. See you tomorrow. Take care.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.